welcome back to the Narratives in Philosophy podcast.
Rest in peace, PPPP.
No comment. So last week we covered a couple of topics which were pretty divergent from the week before. I think we connected them pretty well. We talked a lot about...
narrative.
Well, that's the first thing we talked about.
The power of narrative, and also the influence of narrative on belief, and how it's literally everywhere, so you could call it an a priori.
Ah. So yeah, mainly we talked about narrative. We also got quite a bit into Pascal's Wager, if you recall. We spoke about basically why we should be considering eternal things. And one of the opening remarks I wanted to make in this episode, connecting it right back to that, is the connection between metaphysics and theology.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we're talking about theology, we are trying to be careful to talk about it from a philosophical perspective rather than a religious perspective. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah. Well, I heard it described the way that theology assumes God exists.
Yeah.
Philosophy of God might assume that there is some eternal variable, but doesn't assume that it is a sentient, active,
personable,
anthropomorphized being.
Uh-huh.
Philosophy of religion is literally just questioning everything, just like regular philosophy. It just turns it on religion instead of morality or what have you.
In that way, I would actually characterize this philosophy of God as more interesting than religious theology. And because of the reason, it's broader, it's more open, and it's less structured. And
true.
So what we can do, if you just sit down and think about, what are all the possibilities for eternal beings, for extra-dimensional existence? Like, you can't comprehend any of them, really, but we can consider this massive spectrum of things that might come to our mind.
Absolutely. No.
So this is where I think we want to get started, maybe along the lines of the ontological argument, something like that.
Yeah, there's two people who have made some very interesting philosophy of religion arguments. Aquinas, in his seminal work, Summa Theologica.
Right.
Famous work that is still considered by many people. And if you've read it, you know that he considers everything he can conceive of.
Yeah.
Considers every argument for and against, and then puts forward, and not even necessarily proofs of God, but also just basic theological things. But there is a section of that book where he does put forward his five ways. And today we're going to talk about those five ways, but also I think it's helpful to contrast them to Anselm's argument.
Okay.
So Anselm's argument is known as the ontological argument.
Yeah.
Aquinas comes up with four cosmological arguments, and then he closes with what's called a teleological argument.
Right.
So the names there, ontological, ontology is the study of being, cosmological, he's taking those arguments from observed things in the universe, what he believes is observed, and then teleological, telos means aim or end, or you could call it the thing for which something is purposed.
Yeah.
So there's lots of arguments to consider here and merits to weigh and compare. So
just to, I guess, connect this back to our overall all theme, what we're doing here, we actually did read some of Summa Theologica in our book club, right?
Yeah, we did.
And so that was, roughly we're following our book club's content in order to bring philosophy into this podcast. So in that month, you presented, and
I did.
I listened to it recently, and let me say it was worth listening to multiple times. Your presentation was about an hour long, which I actually want to applaud you on that.
Oh, thank you. I know you
were somewhat apologetic of it, given the setting and the structure, which I understand as well, though it certainly wasn't a problem, even there.
Thank you.
Because that lecture, which was comprised of the life stories of mainly two individuals, although there were a couple other characters in that story, really highlight a lot of the things that you've struggled with, a lot of things that you've dealt with on an intellectual level and grown from. And I know one of the comments actually from Stephen, you know, right off the bat after listening to that was like, this is really reflective of some deep contemplation and deep, you know, mental growth. So
yeah.
Along those lines, I do want to talk about that.
Sure. I can tell you that after reading that and going back and looking at Aquinas's work, I realized I wasn't as far afield as I thought I was. For those who don't know, what I basically did is I wrote a narrative, a story, where there's a Socratic dialogue between the character called the preacher and a character called the learned one, and they discuss philosophy. And eventually they get to the point of philosophy of God, and they discuss things. The learned one specifically brings up something known as an infinite regress, which he sees as an absurdity. He also brings up the deterministic nature of being, talking about his crops and how those things, he can do as much as he wants to do, but ultimately certain movers are out of his control. And that word mover or cause is going to come up again. And, you know, what's interesting is Aquinas starts from this perspective of the, you know, the European farmer. That the kind of way of life is very close to him. So he could put himself in the shoes of a farmer and look out at the world and see these things vast and immovable that are beyond his control, things that he might have called second causes that nevertheless affect his existence and bend things either way. And then he would look at those things and see things behind those things. And that was something that was inherent in the book known as the Dialogues of the Preacher. The preacher gives the answer of faith. So the preacher doesn't necessarily give any sort of philosophy of religion argument that you're going to hear today. He gives the answer of faith, which is just taking things on faith. You know, the learned one says, how can we live in this world and deal with these issues? And then the preacher says, well, what else can you do?
Mm-hmm.
There comes a point where you have to step out and take a step of faith, or at least that's the preacher's core of his argument. And the learned one, at least at first, doesn't really seem to feel okay with that. So if you ever want to read Dialogue of the Preachers or Dialogues of the Preacher, it's definitely worth a read. Shameless plug. Under the pen name Joseph Faraday, you're welcome to look that up on Amazon. It's available. But that's not what we're talking about today, although I appreciate Jacob's encouragement there, because after reading it again, I realized, okay, this is actually closer to what Aquinas was talking about, except the learned one takes the part of the Aquinasian points of view with the preacher arguing for faith. And we aren't necessarily going to do that today, but we're going to discuss a lot. This could be a very long conversation.
Yeah, no need to rush through. I know our opening, maybe we mentioned a few things. That's just because there's just a lot.
There's a lot to connect to. Absolutely.
So, yeah, I definitely wanted to mention this, that monologue, that book up front, because I really do think it is helpful if you are trying to maybe just get into what we're talking about here on a non-technical level. You know,
just a
story.
Symbolic.
Is super. It's parabolistic in simplicity. Like, it's really straightforward to understand. So. So where would you like to start on this?
I was going to ask you if you could give a rundown of Anselm. For those who don't know, in the 900s AD, there's a monk named Anselm who comes up with something called the ontological argument that has been considered back and forth by philosophers for thousands of years. Kant considered it all the way in the 1700s. There's lots of discussion of it. Some people have not liked it, some have liked it.
Yeah, I think Kant was pretty critical, if I recall, but Brandon's totally on point with saying some people like it, some people don't, because there's a great number of very intellectual, very intelligent individuals who have been convinced by this argument.
Yeah.
And on the opposing side, there's equal or more of the same quality brains that simply
are not convinced,
who completely are like, this is so dumb, this is, and we'll, so let's flesh that out. Basically, Anselm argued that God must exist because he is philosophically the greatest thing that we can conceive of, and if we were to try to conceive of the greatest thing that didn't exist, we could always conceive of a greater thing that did exist, so therefore it must exist. Now, immediately the problem arises, isn't this all in our heads? Just because we can conceive of something, does that mean it doesn't exist?
Like, for example, I could conceive of the most amazing unicorn
yeah.
possible. And
so Anselm counters by basically saying, well, of course you can, but you're conceiving of a specific thing. That specific physical thing doesn't have to exist.
It's unnecessary. Whereas,
yeah, it's completely unnecessary. Whereas if we're thinking of a metaphysical thing, it transcends this level of unnecessariness, right? And so Anselm says it necessarily exists outside of this world. The greatest metaphysical reality, truth, is there. So a couple comments on this. Number one, this is an a posteriori argument.
Is it a priori or a posteriori?
A posteriori.
Which one is it?
Wait. No. It's a priori. You're right. The other proofs are a posteriori.
A posteriori is when you begin to
that's like induce, the teleological and the other
induct,
ones. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. Yeah. It's totally a priori argument. It works deductively from an assumed premise. And so I take this to basically mean if you are speaking to someone and you have the same basis, then you can get this argument to work for multiple people. But
yeah.
if you're starting from a different place
different
without the
assumption.
Same assumption, then it doesn't work. So basically we're deducing the existence of God from the assumed premise that the greatest metaphysical being should exist. So that's pretty much my introduction.
How is this
to it.
Not a circular argument? Because when I was doing some research on Anselm, and he, one of the big critiques people give him today is that he begs the question in that his proof functions with the predicate, I believe, and the first statement proving one another.
Yeah.
God exists because he must exist, therefore he exists, or something like that.
That's certainly how it's formulated often. What I'll say is, let's shift this to a little bit of a different basis, because if we try and prove the basis, I think you'll see where people, why people understand this. So basically,
yeah.
let's think of this as, why is anything better than anything else? Do you concede? So this is where the argument really takes place. Do you concede that there are realities greater than other realities? Do you concede that on a metaphysical level there is an idea of truth? And I could go down a list of options, okay? And if you concede of any of them, then I could say, well, where does that reality come from? And the deductiveness here, where this plays out, is basically saying, if you can see that there is a metaphysical quality called truth, where does that come from? It must come from the greatest metaphysical reality, who is God. So that's where Anselm wins people over, I guess.
Yeah, I could totally concede to that. I mean, if I just want to be very cautious with my concession, I would say the concept of existence itself would probably be the first metaphysical reality I would concede to. Because, yes, there's observable existing things, and then there's the concept of anything existing at all.
Yeah.
And the fact that anything exists, and this is what's interesting, is because this is why it's so difficult for me, or I guess what ontology would use is being itself, that anything exists in a state of being, that itself seems to be metaphysical. And once you go above being, is there something greater than being itself? I see something called an infinite regress in there as I'm just hearing what you say. Because if there is nothing greater than being itself, then being has just propagated itself infinitely. To many people, that seems absurd. But let's just assume for a second that I don't think that's absurd.
Okay.
That instead, there has to be something greater than being.
Yeah.
There's still an assumption there.
There is.
But there has to be something greater than being itself, because otherwise, why would being be able to make itself be?
But then you go down the route of infinite regress, because you're basically saying being is a created concept.
Yeah.
They must have a creator. And the trouble here is the unmoved mover argument, right?
Let's think about it a second. Infinite regress, what does that mean?
Yep.
Well, what I have heard that means, and you correct me if I'm wrong here, is that something cannot infinitely go on, especially in the physical realm. Like, I can't say a man propagated his seed and then we have infinite propagation of seed going back as infinitely into the past and going on infinitely into the future. So that's infinite regression. But the reason this gets tricky is, why must we necessarily assume that there is a greater metaphysical concept than being? This is one of the problems I see with the ontological argument.
Okay, I think I understand what you're saying.
There might be, being is the infinite variable here, and it stops there.
That's good. That's good. So I did want to talk about this a little bit more, because the argument, as I stated, is effectively trying to say, because there is a metaphysical concept such as being, which is, I think, a fair place to start, therefore there must be the greater metaphysical concepts. And that greatest is a person of deity, a person God. So it is tricky drawing those lines. I guess
it's tough to not make arbitrary lines in the sand.
Yeah.
In this deductive argument.
This is where the a priori quality really comes in.
People have different a priori's, I guess, that they hold to be self-evident.
Right.
Hmm.
Why something exists rather than nothing? I think that's a great question, and that kind of leads us towards
the cosmological arguments.
Yeah. Other arguments.
What's tough here is that ontology is almost impossible to divide from cosmology, and it's almost like the ontological arguments begin to have a bit more weight whenever the cosmological arguments are considered.
I think that's true.
There's a source text that Aquinas used. I heard a Franciscan friar do a talk on this, and he mentioned Romans 1, where it says the eternal attributes have been clearly perceived in the things that have been made. So Aquinas would look at that verse and say, okay, things that have been made are the second causes, and the eternal attributes are somewhat further back. Maybe they're the metaphysical realities you mentioned, and then there's prime movement, prime cause, first cause, whatever you want to call it. And the first argument I would ask you about is the argument from first mover.
Okay.
What might be an image we could give to explain this? First movement. You could think of it maybe in terms of a row of dominoes. But is that a metaphysical reality or a physical reality?
Yeah, it is a bit tricky. The first mover concept basically arises from the fact that no matter how you conceive of beginnings, whether you're thinking from an atheistic standpoint, even a pantheistic standpoint, monotheistic, whichever, you have some sort of metaphysical reality. And the atheist and agnostic out there might be worried because I just said atheists start with metaphysical reality. I guess I'll revise that by saying some of them admit of it. Effectively, they think something came out of complete nothing, or perhaps there was some sort of fundamental essence, which I would say is metaphysical, which has always existed, be that the universe always existing or whatever. It has to be metaphysical in order for it to always exist.
Well, let's think about this for a second. Let's just play here with Aquinas.
Yeah.
Let's maybe play with them. Okay, you look at the fossil record. All right. What's in the fossil record?
A whole bunch of
fossils.
Fossils.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So then the next question. See, we're going back here. We're seeing if we can go back infinitely.
Okay.
Where do these fossils come from?
Previous animals who have died. And been fossilized.
Been fossilized over time. And you can go back. Can that go on and on and on and on and on and on and on? Eventually, we get to a point where the planet was in some sort of primordial state.
Okay.
And eventually, we get to the point where we have to say, well, where did the planet come from?
Yeah.
Now, the answer is given there, what do those typically get?
Theories that go back to the Big Bang.
Yeah.
Or that go back to the first mover.
So then you go to the Big Bang.
Yeah.
We've gone back even further. Okay, we know that planets, stars, whatever, what have you, have come about from this cataclysmic event. How did the Big Bang occur? So I've gone as far back as I can here, and then I'm up against a wall of some sort. And again, I'm only considering physical things, but eventually I get to a point where I have to either admit that something came from nothing, or I have to admit that somewhere in there was an eternal infinite variable. And I'm calling it as mathematical and scientific of a term as possible because we can't really say what it is. I can't see what
from
it
this
is.
This theory, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, but that's the first mover. We go back as far as we want, and the Big Bang
and there's something
gives
there.
Us two choices.
Yeah.
We have two choices. There's an unmoved mover or something came from nothing. Let's talk about something came from nothing. Is that possible?
Now, some people have tried to argue that it is possible.
But is that a physical possibility? I mean, there's all
not
of these...
Not as far as science can know. Not as far as we can tell. There's no evidence to ever say that something just spawns from nothing. There's all the evidence to say that that doesn't happen.
Like, is there even a variable in mathematics for nothingness? Does that exist? And would it even work if it's not multiplied by some other variable?
Zero is really probably
the problem
the
is there.
I still
see an infinite regress there
in
multiplying something infinitely by zero. So it's like multiplying zero by zero.
Divide by zero. No, absolutely.
And again, I'm sorry. I am not a mathematical wizard. I am not a scientist, but... Again, we're all just considering this as far back as we can, and this is the line of thought that anybody can take.
Yeah, if we sit back, if we lay our, you know, at night, when everything's quiet, and consider, where did this all come from? You'll get to the same place, where it's like, well, even if there was a Big Bang, that Big Bang had physical attributes. People have calculated the density, for instance, of the point in space that must be. And when it comes down to it, that density is... absurd. It can't exist. We can't comprehend how that could ever come to be. And then to consider, how might that have just spawned from absolute nothing?
We have two choices, it seems.
You got nothing there, yeah.
So, you know, some people I've heard have postulated, waving hands at the air, that energy, some sort of energy, is the infinite variable in this system. And this is something that I'm sure other people have described, but I, in my philosophical thought, have always described it as the existential beyond, where the human brain gets to a precipice where they can't see into the abyss.
Yeah.
Something is there, and we're given two choices, nothingness or a prime motion.
This is kind of what I was getting at when I was saying even atheists will admit of some sort of metaphysical reality when it comes to the cosmological argument. They just won't admit of any sort of thing that we might call God.
Yeah, it's an unsentient essence or something.
I really appreciate that concession when it's made because it does show, in my mind, some reasonableness to say something can't come from absolute nothing. Everything can't come from absolute nothing.
Yeah,
I can't respect the reasonableness of that argument, even though some very reasonable people have made it. It doesn't cope well with me. I don't think it copes well with anyone who really tries to work it out.
Intense cognitive dissonance.
Yeah,
it's very tough.
So whether that's energy or, you know, some sort of underlying fundamental reality behind the finite realm, you know, we have to admit of it. I think that's the strength of this cosmological argument.
And it's interesting because people still, like you said, sometimes they make that concession, sometimes they won't. I read an article in, I believe, a scientific journal, it might have been Popular Mechanics, where something else, it might have been Science Daily, I don't know, where they felt very uncomfortable with the presence of the infinite variable in physics.
Okay.
So... and they seem to believe that it's possible to remove the infinite variable, which I believe is like literally the infinity sign.
I mean, they're probably referring to the universe being infinite. They're probably just saying it was finite universe, which is pretty... as far as I know, that's the popular exception when it comes to physics.
Yeah, is there any physical system scientifically to prove an infinite universe that has existed... world without end, amen. I mean, that's what the Greeks, I think. Some of the Greeks believe that there was an infinite universe.
Yeah, some people believe it. We have evidence that it's expanding, which kind of implies
that there had to be some...
there was a beginning, and therefore it's not infinite. So that's the normal train of thought.
Which is so interesting, because that's why Aristotle talks about motion and movers, and Aquinas talks about motion and movers. And it assumes that if there is motion, there's a starting point for that motion.
Yeah, absolutely. Because that's how we observe the world. You know, if something's moving, something causes it to move.
Yeah.
So
then that's really interesting, because the mover there would be the Big Bang, or mm-hmm. where the movement began is a way to edit that statement. Where the movement began was the Big Bang.
Right.
And that's where things get interesting, because now we get into causation. Aquinas asserts that everything has a cause.
Yeah.
So let's just think of a simple cause and effect and see how far back we can take it.
As in something that's going on in the present day?
Yeah, just anything. Let's see if there's anything that doesn't have an effect. I mean, doesn't have a cause that caused it.
Oh, gosh.
Like, I'm looking at your carpet right now.
Okay.
Did someone build this carpet?
Yeah.
I guess there's a factory somewhere where this carpet was made.
Yeah.
Did the materials exist forever and ever without end, amen?
No.
Okay. Okay, bad example. How about this? Propagation of the species. All right.
Okay.
You and I both have children.
Yeah.
Something happened. Wink, wink. Somewhere back in the past that caused the effect, which is a child.
Yeah.
Where did that begin? We can go back and go back and go back, but we get into that problem yet again of what? Infinite
regress.
Infinite
yeah.
regress,
absolutely.
Where I can't...
you can't even conceive of anything. What we're getting at here is we can't come up with any practical examples where stuff happens without a cause.
Or happens infinitely in the past and infinitely in the future, and it's this vast continuum.
Right. And I want to specify, in the finite realm, we can't conceive of that. It's
yeah.
just we're obeying the laws of physics by not being eternal.
Like, this is literally why the ontological argument is so powerful, I think, going back to Anselm.
Yeah.
Because unless you admit of the finite existing next to the infinite,
right.
which I think Anselm's trying to get at the infinite, and almost had all of these cosmological arguments of Aquinas in the back of his mind,
yeah.
that because all of these things are, because we can't have an infinite train of cause and effect, because we have to have a first movement, because of that, there has to be some sort of metaphysical reality.
Yeah, that's from that's the basis that you have to get to before considering the ontological argument seriously.
And that's what's... I only just now realized that ultimately, when the ontological argument is just kind of floating in air...
If it's by itself, if it's just...
It's just stupid.
You know, because I've thought of God, therefore he must exist. You're going to have a hard time swallowing that.
Okay, so that's interesting. That makes me feel a bit better
okay,
than
good.
I did at the beginning of this
good,
podcast
good.
About the ontological
yeah,
argument.
Yeah, because you were all like, this argument's terrible. And I was like, eh, it's not that bad.
Yeah, okay, so this is better. We can't have an infinite chain of cause and effect, and Aquinas would have asserted that at the beginning of that is the first cause. But again... Here's the problem of my reasoning. I have this existential beyond that I can't seem to cross over to get to what this first cause might be.
Right.
And this is the big problem. A lot of people assert wildly to the wind of what the first cause is. Is there any way to mathematically prove a first cause?
As in qualities of the first cause or general first cause in the first place?
How about both?
Oh. We're talking about the latter.
Yeah.
Right? We're talking about how we might get at understanding that there is a first mover. So there's the Platonic argument, and then there's all of these other arguments that we've been dancing around. Mathematically, I think the unmoved mover concept is as close as we can get. I think it's a logic, you know, reasoning-based approach. And we've really fleshed that out in the last, you know, 10, 15 minutes or so.
Yeah, it's just first mover and first cause are very related.
Yeah.
You know, there's a cause for motion.
The unmoved mover.
Yeah.
So, I guess I would tentatively say, yes, we can arrive at the conclusion that there is metaphysical beyond our finite. Now,
yeah.
what that is, I don't think that we can get very far...
Yeah.
Mathematically.
And
now,
then that's where Aquinas tries to get there.
Okay.
In his third argument. He talks about contingency.
Yeah.
He sees a world of perishable things. Stars perish, form black holes, if I'm not butchering my eighth grade science knowledge. the universe, some have argued, is going to drift apart so much that it might perish, although some then say it will contract again and then will infinitely contract and expand. Who knows? Who knows? But I can't point to a single thing in this physical world that is not perishable. Can you, Sir Jacob?
Nothing that's not conceptual. Nothing yeah. physical.
This desk is decaying before our very eyes.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
This computer is going to infinitely get slower.
Oh, no. No!
Not the computer. I mean,
it's the concept of entropy.
Things just decay.
Yeah. And we could get into that technically. I don't think it's necessary, though. So, yeah, things absolutely do decay.
Yeah.
I guess I'm still thinking about how in the world we can know anything about this eternal being. Or this eternal...
Yeah. And that,
reality.
That's the idea, is that if all things are perishable, one thing we can know is that there has to be something imperishable for there to be things that are perishable. Otherwise, nothing would exist. Eventually, everything would die and disappear.
I mean, I think that's approaching the ontological argument again, but...
Yet again, we get a problem of infinite regress if everything is just perishable and propagating itself, perishing to the end of time.
I would say that's tricky, what you just said, because I don't know that people listening are just going to agree with your statement of because there's perishable, therefore there's an imperishable.
Yeah, it's tough. It's an assumption. And, you know, that's something that's inherent in his system. Who's to say an infinite regress is necessarily impossible?
Yeah.
I mean, this was something that Nietzsche kind of got at when he mentioned... what did he call it? Infinite return.
Oh, yeah.
That a demon comes to him in a dream and says, what if I told you you would live this life in exact detail forever? And it's almost a thought experiment, but it's also something that he eternal recurrence, that's it. He elevated the idea of eternal recurrence to this... chief doctrine of his system, and I've never heard anybody try to prove, and it's almost like an eternal regress, this eternal recurrence.
Yeah, it is.
And that's the
circular.
Big thing.
Yeah.
Literally the foundation of a system based on eternal regress is amazing to me. So is there any, do we have any right to say that that can't happen? This is where things get really tricky.
Things get hairy, yeah.
I mean, we could just take the end of Nietzsche's life, and this is just a terrible below-the-belt punch. And I'm not actually making this argument. I'm just saying what
some people
might say.
Politely.
That infinite regress as a foundation for your entire system might just lead to going insane, hugging a horse's neck in the streets of Turin, Italy, which is what happened to Nietzsche. But also there is the simple fact that he didn't go insane from his system. Many people have said he had syphilis, and he didn't get it from sexual affairs. He got it from being an ambulance driver in the Prussian military. So it's tough. The problem is difficult. We could just assert that infinite regress is the foundation of being.
I'll say, in a practical sense, we're not okay with that answer of infinite regress.
It does make me slightly uncomfortable.
Because our lives are exposed to... a temporal cycle. Our lives go through a period of time. And then we die and we move on. And pretty much in every philosophy, even those that are like reincarnation, you can't just repeat time. Right? There's no like looping.
There's
going
this
on.
Sense of boundness that you can't really get away. Otherwise you're writing a science fiction novel.
Yeah, so long as time goes on, and you're not time traveling like science fiction novels, which is really tricky to make work because it's so unreasonable. I think everyone's going to be okay with being not okay with infinite regress. So long as time moves, infinite regress should not exist.
Yeah, in a world that is based upon the Nietzschean idea of eternal recurrence or eternal regress, then contingency would not be a thing. Nothing would be contingent on anything, it would simply be as it is.
I may have gotten the terms mixed up.
Oh, no, it's fine. They're basically the same thing.
Meaning.
They're basically the same thing.
Right.
And but we're not necessarily living in that world. It might be a safe assumption to say that's not the world we're living in, so contingency, so perishing.
Right.
But it brings us back to the same question. We have two options yet again. Either things eternally can perish and eternally die, which is an infinite regress, that's an eternal recurrence, the Nietzschean idea,
yeah.
Or four things perishable to exist, yet on that same thing, there has to be something imperishable.
Right.
Now, does that again have to be a sentient Judeo-Christian God? Maybe
we
not.
We don't know yet. Yeah.
We don't know.
We've not gotten there.
But we do know there's something very infinite that is imperishable. That seems to be a safe assumption.
Yeah. I think where we've gotten, just to summarize, is basically saying, as best we can understand, as best we can reason, and maybe this does need some more formal philosophy to work itself out, I'm not aware of it. Because time, because the space-time continuum, we could even say, we can pretty confidently assert, I'm not going to say prove, this is where the other philosophical work might come in, that there's not an infinite recurrence, there's not an infinite regress, neither. So there must be this unmoved mover. And let me just take this right back to where we started. I think this is the a priori. I think we are making that slight little jump, and we've reduced that jump to as small as we can.
No, it's going to get
smaller.
Hopefully
everyone
too.
Can take it with, you know, take it now. That there yeah. is.
Because the last argument of Aquinas tends to get very, very close, like right up on the edge, possibly even into the territory of the ontological argument, because it's the argument from degrees of perfection. He says it's possible to conceive of varied levels of perfection in a thing. Now, the Nietzschean response to this is, values are just transmuted from whoever's living at that particular time.
Yeah.
But, you know, there do seem to be eternal values of morality and goodness.
Yeah.
I mean,
and I actually don't give too much weight to this argument in the context of speaking to those under the Nietzschean philosophy, under the Nietzschean worldview, because his answers are maybe unprovably difficult to get around. I don't think that we can convince people that humans, this world, has fundamental qualities of goodness or fundamental goals.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and take the part of those who would say it does. I'm
sure.
going to put a statement forward that could be the beginning of a logical syllogism.
Okay. And we were talking about the teleological argument now.
We're now actually good. Arguments of degree.
Okay.
Arguments of degree still. We're going to get to the teleological argument, but the argument here is cultures that accept murder tend to be less... what's the word?
Prosperous?
Not prosperous. Less, there's less of them. Less fruitful.
Prominent? Fruitful?
Less fruitful. Cultures that
less
accept...
Less of them exist?
Less of them exist.
Sure.
Okay, so we could agree to that?
We can absolutely agree to that, yeah. Everyone, Nietzschean influencer or otherwise, can agree to that.
Okay, okay. So if murder is totally okay...
Yeah.
Cultures will die off that accept that. So
right.
It's almost like there's an evolutionary sense.
There is an evolutionary fitness to certain morality. That's not to say that in the future there won't be a different evolutionary fitness for morality.
Oh, I tried. Okay.
And so if it shifts, then there's not an absolute morality, right? That's the argument.
Okay.
And so I think it's a fair argument.
But then the problem, it is a fair argument. There's just no way to prove
now
that it will fish shift in the future.
You know, human consciousness, and there's the issue of how in the world would we shift to such a place where the things which we consider vices now are somehow virtues? I think it's really hard to conceive of that. I won't say it's absolutely impossible, but this is why I was saying I think it's not necessarily the argument I would bring to the table when trying to convince someone.
Yeah.
It's not that it's
so that makes the
wrong.
Argument from degree... From the Aquinas perspective, very difficult to perhaps put forward, especially in this world of Nietzschean thought, where ultimately Nietzsche would argue what makes the human race able to survive everything that was once his vice has created his virtue.
That's right.
So,
quote, yeah.
Or something like that. It's probably
No, that's really close. I remember.
Yeah, it is.
That.
It's tough. It's tough in this world to make that argument, but we can still say it's possible to come up with a more perfect mathematical chair, perhaps. So there is a degree inherent in that, maybe.
Okay.
I'm really trying to argue for old Aquinas here.
Trying to get those degrees going.
I'm really trying.
Yeah, I'm not as familiar with this argument, so I can't really say. We're approaching ontological all over again once we start talking about the degrees of goodness in things.
Sure.
I'll just repeat kind of what I said in the first place. If we want to, or if we can admit of any degrees of goodness, then we're admitting of a metaphysical reality of goodness.
Hmm.
And when we start to consider that, it's like, well, if it's metaphysical, it's unlimited, physically speaking, it must be the greatest. What is the greatest? It's one that exists rather than doesn't exist. And perhaps a whole bunch of other attributes which we aren't going to be as sure of. We can be sure that it exists rather than doesn't because, well, that's definitely better.
Hmm.
But beyond that, so that, anyways, I think you've approached the ontological all over again with this
one. So we'll just admit that the argument from degree is perhaps one of the weaker ones, but contingency, causation, and prime movers seem rather reasonable in a world that is not peopled with constant skeptics. But alas, that is not our world. Okay, so teleological argument. The word telos, I believe, means end or aim.
Yeah, it's like a goal, even,
you
could say, or a purpose.
Yeah.
Something like that.
And that's intriguing to me because that therefore means that this argument is based upon the ends of things.
Yes.
So the ones that we've looked at so far seem to look into the past.
Yeah.
This one seems to look into the future.
It does. And it tries to use the past as a guide.
Yeah.
Ultimately, what the teleological argument gets at here is a meta-narrative, I think, is the most colloquially accepted way of talking about it. Basically, a teleological argument says, because a meta-narrative exists, therefore God.
Yeah, and you could even extrapolate on that more. It seems to say that only intelligent creatures can set a telos, telos, an end.
Yeah.
I'm trying not to mispronounce my Greek, so logos, telos.
Sure.
Intelligent creatures set ends for their actions. And there's the same thing here. Constantly you see this domino chain. The thought is that unintelligent things have a telos, not just intelligent things, is what it argues. So you look at oceans.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if this is a very strong argument, or I'm just not arguing it very much, because the argument goes something like this. How can unintelligent things have a telos if some master telos did not set that telos for them?
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement.
That's tough, though.
But go on.
Do unintelligent things really do that, though? Something Aquinas might say is that, okay, the ocean exists to give water for the fish to live in, and water that we can purify and make drinkable for humans, but another person might just say, oh, well, we've evolved to figure that out.
It just evolved that way, yeah.
We've figured out how to do that. So telos seems less powerful. I'm beginning to see this.
The evolutionary theory certainly is opposed to the teleologic argument.
Yeah.
I still think it's probably the strongest of the, let's say, natural theology arguments. Just because people do tend to see purposes in things. And I'm not convinced that evolutionary theory actually adequately explains these purposes. They attempt to. They certainly do in some cases. But when it comes down to it, there's literally purpose in everything, you know? We don't have anything without purpose, kind of like what you're getting at.
Yeah, like a lion, its telos of its talons is to get dinner.
Yeah, maybe, you know, it evolved to have fitness like that, but wouldn't things evolve more randomly? Like, wouldn't there be some things which didn't have good purposes? And we call those, like, vestigial, you know, organs and whatnot.
It's tough.
Anyways, I think it's a reasonably good argument. However,
yeah.
when offered the alternative theory of evolution, it does certainly shake.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I think I feel least comfortable with this teleological argument. The first three cosmological ones seem to get my reasoning up to the point where I have to consider the possibility of this divine being. And that puts me in a place where I'm like, if eternity exists, then life must be spent making eternity good, else eternal suffering. That's the statement I get to. But
yeah.
Nevertheless, that could be a logical leap, and that brings me to the second problem on my problem list. Is there a logical leap to merely get to the point where you say biblical view of God from all of these arguments? Because Aquinas
yes.
comes to these points and then says, oh,
therefore,
male anthropomorphized yeah. Judeo-Christian God of the Catholic quality.
Yeah. My short answer is yes, there is the leap.
And I guess our answer to that leap would be what we said in the last episode.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what if it is correct to view it from this perspective?
Pascal's wager, yeah.
Yeah.
So one of the questions that kind of comes up here is when you're looking at all of these arguments, if you are trying to convince someone, maybe we should include in the list like the
anthropomorphized.
Anthropological argument?
And anthropological.
And thank you. Yeah.
Let me see.
This one. Anthropological. You got it.
Anthropological argument. Yes. Yes,
anyways,
yes, yes.
We could maybe include that on the list as an option as well. Which ones would you actually use? Which ones would you actually bring to bear? So pick three. What's your answer?
So just pick three world religions?
No. Pick three of the arguments that we've been talking about. And maybe,
okay.
maybe Pascal's wagers
yeah,
on the
sure.
list.
If
as
I
well.
Were to bring arguments to bear, I would pick, for me, the strongest would be causation, first mover, and then the if-then-else statement that we came up with in the last
okay.
thing. I think that gets me sufficiently into the existential beyond, where I'm
yeah.
not claiming to know the answers, but I know enough to know that things are worth
so you're still
thinking
not
about.
Describing this being, right?
But I'm at the point where I'm trying to make as many good decisions as possible.
So yeah, that was kind of my point to the question. What are we really saying with these arguments? Because I think you're right. We're not just jumping to the Catholic or Christian or Judeo God. We are jumping to a place of, you know, perhaps moral responsibility, perhaps a certitude of eternal being, be that personal, I don't know. I think we can get quite a bit further through reasoning, through working it out. I think creation does reveal the attributes of God, as you may have said.
All right, well then, I have made my arguments. I have stated what I feel comfortable with from a very natural perspective, and now enter theology student
yeah.
in master's degree. So I will, if you don't mind, put you to the question.
Okay.
You mentioned something in your statement that it's possible to reason beyond. I see an existential beyond.
Yeah.
I feel very uncomfortable treading into that existential beyond with anything but the if-then-else statement.
Okay.
What other tools might you give to those who want to soar through this existential beyond or get through it slowly and cautiously? Maybe not soar.
In both answers, what actually comes to mind is this beautiful thing we call reason. And this actually touches on the
anthropological
argument. Because it's basically saying humans specifically are of sufficient, we'll just say something like awesomeness or interest.
Grandeur.
That they reveal something of this eternal being. And so when you tack that maybe onto the list of three or four other arguments that we've worked through, I would pick cosmological, ontological, and Pascal's wager. So very similar to your list. You start kind of having to say, well, this God must be like this. This God must be like this. Now, reason is difficult, well, like we've talked about in all of our episodes previously, because observation is difficult, and reason relies on observation. Effectively, we are talking about science when we start down this path. And
so observations of the human person.
Of the human
P.
person and of creation in general. I want to kind of focus on the human person.
I like
but
this.
Creation in general is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, so this is very new to me, so I'm gonna ask some questions then.
Sure.
What might be some scientifically observed general statements that people would accept to be true about the human person that might be the foundation for this argument?
Yeah. It gives me pause because some things come to mind, but I don't know that it fulfills the criteria that you put out of you know, scientific, generally accepted, all of that. Because I could say something like, well, humans are bipartite. They have spirit, they have body. You know, I could say something like that, and then you'd say, well, a bunch of people don't believe that.
Well, there might be other things you could do. I mean, do people generally like to live?
Yeah, sure. But again, there might be reasons other than what I'd like to get at for why that's the case.
Okay, well then I will listen then, because what I'm getting
it's
from you is
question,
that it's possible
but
to get a physical bridge over this existential beyond.
Mm-hmm.
So if you imagine we've gone all the way up to the precipice with the cosmological and the wager,
yeah,
and then the wager somehow gets you soaring out into the existential beyond, you don't know where you're going to land, but I hear hope in your
I think there is hope.
Is a bridge. So what is this bridge?
Effectively, what I would argue is look into yourself, use your reason, and see what comes out. What you will find in all men is various longings, various tendencies. You might find, I can do evil, and you might have a hard time finding, I can do good. Maybe you can't. That's one reasoning route I actually went down. Do you ever do anything solely for the good of others? And the more I looked into it in myself, the more my answer was no, because I saw my motives in every case. In every single case, whether it was, you know, on the outside, it was pure just generosity. I give tons of money away, we'll say. Made me feel good. That was my motive. It was me. At the bottom of that, did I enjoy helping others? Absolutely. Was it synergistic? Was it, you know, good for them too? Absolutely. But the motive there, the ultimate one, if it made me feel bad, would I do it? Heck no. If giving away money made you feel bad, for whatever reason, would you do it? Everyone says,
generally it's accepted, no.
Why would you do it?
Yeah, like in these kind of questions, folks, a lot of people love to just kind of play gotcha moments and just talk about the outliers. You can't build reality on outliers. Yes, there are people who have so much depression that they want death. Does that mean that you can form a system of existence on those who want death? You can't. So generally true statement. People tend, like you just mentioned, is our recording still going,
oh,
by the way?
Yeah.
Just like you just mentioned, people tend to do something for some sort of perceived inner benefit.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So that's one thing I think is universally available for us to find just by looking in ourselves using reason. And I think what is so crazy about this particular revelation is that it shows you that there should be the other option. There should be the option of actually just doing good for other people's sake, actually just self-sacrificing. And yet it's not available to us.
Could that be an evolutionary development that if everyone self-sacrificed, no one would exist?
It could be. But why is it literally never an option?
Is it necessarily never an option?
That's what I'm asserting. I think if you look deeply enough within yourself, you will find that it's actually never an option.
Interesting.
So I am certainly bordering on religious things immediately.
Because the Nietzschean answer to this is then what makes that which is never an option the ideal good? What if good is what is good to as many people as possible? As long as everybody gets some good from it, this is the foundation of culture, of economics, of trading ideas.
And
these are all healthy things.
Certainly, healthy might be the right word for it, because we do build good things, we could say, from these systems. So you're asking what makes this concept of a truly self-sacrificing good, the ultimate one, again, I think it's within us. I think it's inherent. If you look deeply enough, you'll be like, well, that's actually what's good. So I'm like you said, we've gone off, we've jumped off the cliff into the existential, perhaps, abyss.
But, you know, another tool that might help us in this abyss is the Platonic divided line of cognition. You have found a sort of line where there's almost this ideal form of perfect altruism.
Mm-hmm.
And we want that perfect altruism to be there, to be real.
Yeah.
I wonder if we could apply this to other things, like people, and this is going to come up, folks, in our next book club, which you should listen to. People tend to buy things.
Yeah.
So I'm going to continue to try to fuse my reasoning with Jacob's on this, because I think we're going the same direction.
Sure, go ahead.
This is still an anthropological argument. Why do people buy things?
For themselves.
Okay, for themselves. Do they buy... like, let's talk about people who get to the point where they're buying so much that they no longer have a material need. Why do people do that?
I guess I would say there's still behind it, there's some self-centered motive. It might be security, it might be pride, it might be something like,
what's interesting,
I
is
have money, I should spend it.
All of those words you just mentioned,
yeah,
get into metaphysical things that must be realities.
Okay.
A hoarder, perhaps, let's
yeah.
talk about this hypothetical hoarder, buys things because he or she has this conception that if he buys enough, he won't satisfy a material need. He will satisfy an immaterial need known as peace of mind.
Ah.
Peace. So think about this in the animal kingdom, folks. Lions do not gorge themselves beyond the point of healthfulness. They are constantly serving a physical need. But humans have this strange ability, it seems, to when they are interacting with physical things, they are somehow interacting with immaterial, metaphysical things, and we can't get away from that.
There's peace.
There's this attribute we found there.
I like where you're going. I feel like there might be a bit of a evolutionary alternative here as well. That these maybe negative side effects or consequences arose accidentally along with the creativity and higher intelligence that humans have. Now, I don't know how you would evolutionarily argue with that. I wouldn't, personally.
It's tough to do.
But you can almost tack on, oh, you know, we have these traits because we evolved. For anything you want to.
But there's no way to really step-by-step do what
that's
you and I
really
are doing.
That's actually interesting. It's a good example of evolutionary unfitness that we're saying co-evolved with evolutionary fitness. And it's like, well, why did the unfitness evolve? Why is that necessary? If lions are better at this, if monkeys are better at this than we are, why couldn't we have just maintained that betterness while we grew other betternesses, you know?
There's definitely a question there.
So
and
here's a question. I think I'll just go along with what you said of saying we're interacting with metaphysical realities and see, did you want to go somewhere further with that?
Yeah.
Because I think I agree with you.
Think about it again. We found peace as this attribute at the end of the action.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back one in the chain, love. We have innumerable amount of sexual partners to the detriment to our physical bodies. Animals don't have this problem. Animals don't seem to deal with this.
For the most part.
Yeah, you know, there isn't like this disease that strikes them in their bodies, and it's very tragic. But typically they propagate, and one time a season, whenever the female of the species is ready, and whenever the, like fish, for example, there's a season where they are spawning, and it fits a very simple need. Then you have this humanness that comes into being where the physical act is done again and again and again and again. And there's this depth that opens up in the human soul. And notice I now made a critical error. I said the word human soul. Because yes, folks, there seems to be this immaterial longing when you are getting on Tinder and swiping left and right infinitely. You're not just solving a physical need. You want love. I think millennials at least know this better than anyone. We can admit to that better than anyone. Now, that's me just making a bunch of emotional arguments, but what else do we have in this metaphysical world that we're jumping into, this anthropological argument?
It's tricky. Again, you know, we could say that it's all, you know, evolved need, and love is, you know, a guiding force that helps us procreate, but
it doesn't seem to solve an evolutionary problem anymore, that physical thing.
We disagree, you know? It's just not. And yeah. I think you're right. I think there is another metaphysical reality there of love, of
peace. Now let's go even further. Euphoria.
Okay.
Why do people do drugs?
Yeah.
This is one of the most hilarious things. You don't see animals bending their faculties to induce this state of what some have called joy, but we will call the Greek word euphoria.
Okay.
We're just going to keep going down the list, and I think you know where I'm getting this.
Sure.
It's yet again another attribute that you mentioned in the anthropological argument. They're doing it because they want joy, euphoria. That's not an evolutionary helpful thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, I
imagine there are some animals out there who, you know, eat shrooms or something, and it makes them feel nice. And that's that.
And they go to bed and they sleep, whatever.
But what Brandon's getting at here is the extent and the abuse, right, that humans do to their detriment rather than to their benefit.
Mm. So we've got love, we've got joy, euphoria, we've got peace. Then there's things that, you know, we can kind of lump together into this sense of goodness. Even when one does an act of evil, I would assert, which I think is in stating with your anthropological argument, that perhaps they are trying to do good in some sense. Let's take the most evil person we can think of. Adolf Hitler.
Okay.
Actions that he did were not necessarily aimed at being the most terrible guy possible, but trying to bring about a perfection of goodness for his people.
He was attempting to bring about a utopia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is in his system, a pinnacle of human goodness. Now, we wouldn't call what he did goodness, but is that necessarily far off the mark from what many of us do? Like you mentioned, giving money. There's a sense there that you didn't get the physical variable of less material goods or more material goods. You got an immaterial good of goodness.
Mm-hmm.
A sense of your own
made you feel good.
Goodness. But at the end of all of these material actions, we're getting again and again and again a metaphysical, immaterial thing. Why are people so interested in the Western world about racial tolerance? It's almost like a kind of gentleness, a kind of ability to be good and put up with anything that might be an evolutionary baked-in distance that is put between races. There's a desire to overcome that.
Yeah.
Lions don't have conferences to discuss the terrible problems between antelopes and lions.
That's true.
You cannot make the evolutionary argument that white is superior or black is superior or anything like that. Instead, what we do is we have conferences to bring about greater gentleness and tolerance and goodness between the races.
Hmm.
I mean, we have Donald Trump getting up on stage in Dallas just the yesterday, meeting with ministers from black churches. Why is he doing that? I mean, there's probably a physical benefit, i.e., being elected, but he knows that the unphysical benefit of greater perceived tolerance and goodness and gentleness between the races is something that will get him a physical benefit. Now, whether or not that's good or not, we can argue about that forever. But the point stands. This anthropological argument could have something to it.
Yeah.
At the end of every single one of these actions is not an infinite regress of the material. It ends in some sort of immaterial.
Yeah, I really completely agree when it comes down to it. I think that this anthropological. Thank you.
Yeah.
I can say it after you say it. It's weird. The argument basically points at attributes which are those of God.
when it comes down to it. And we can start calling this metaphysical reality God once it has attributes. Among those attributes, I'd say that we can find in the same way is that of personhood, that of being. We exist with a deeper level of reality than biological machines. Again, if you look deeply enough into yourself, if you look at your motives, if you look at the realities around you, many people have come to find this to be true.
It seems to be a sort of individualism that the human species can have, whereas there's a school of fish that can move in perfect unison, change directions on the perception of a predator in perfect unison, but you can't... It's very difficult to get people to believe the same thing, do the same thing, move the same way.
Yeah, I don't know if that specifically points to the spirit, but... in fact, I'll go further. I don't know that anything specifically that you can point out about humans points to a spirit, which is a superior form of being or existence, except themselves in their own considerations within themselves. It's something that we believe just inherently. Just, you know, I wouldn't say a priori exactly, but something along those lines. So...
Yeah, I will quote something here that I think goes with what you're saying.
Sure.
And this will come up again for those of you who follow what we're doing on Positive Perspectives. Quote, "So at last perhaps we may define our individual, a person with infinite needs and an infinite desire to travel upward, yet trapped in a finite continuum of materiality. To where, he knows not. Our problems lie between desire and doubt. Our solutions lie in a sea of material possibilities, and our final fulfillment remains as elusive as eternity within the heart. For these things, immaterial or metaphysical, words fail." Unquote. And that's something that I think defines the individual in the human kingdom. The animal kingdom doesn't have this propensity towards infinity to do things infinitely because they want to garner an infinite variable that is outside themselves that seems to leave them lacking. There's a scratching of the physical itch, and then that's it.
That's that. They move on. Yeah, absolutely. So whether you take that to mean we have a spirit or not, I don't know that I care necessarily. It could also be just semantics that I'm using the terminology spirit. We could say something maybe closer to what Brandon just said of, this is what makes us individuals. This is what makes us people. Regardless, I think that this is perhaps the most important attribute to consider when thinking of a creator. As a person beyond that, who loves. And this is where we get the triune aspect. And I could maybe go on, and I think we perhaps will in future episodes, of...
Yeah.
Ways we can identify attributes of God from, you know, outside of, like, special revelation.
Sure.
One of the things I wanted to bring up at this stage in this discussion, though, is something like the problem of evil.
Sure.
Because when we are doing our observations in this world, like I recommended, when we are using reason to try and figure out what this God is all about, we will hit this barrier called the problem of evil, philosophically speaking, that says, well, if this God exists and he's good, because ontologically speaking, from the ontological argument, he's the best. If he's good and evil exists, why doesn't he wipe out evil? Why does evil exist? If, you know, an all-powerful, all-knowledgeable, good God exists.
Yeah.
So... Can I get your reaction to that?
Yeah. I would say that the problem is easily fixed from the status that ontology is just in our imagination. We don't live in a world, some would assert, that is based upon the conceptions in the human mind of what goodness must be. Although it's definitely weighty that we have that weight of goodness weighing upon us that something must be infinitely good, nevertheless, the physical reality is that seems to be the Nietzschean reality, that vices allow races to exist, allow species to exist. The lion eats the antelope. Now, when you take that to its full extent, however, and apply that from the animal kingdom to the human kingdom, you get actions such as Adolf Hitler's.
Yeah.
He's just looking at it as a world of lion and antelopes, winners and losers, the hunters and hunted. That doesn't seem to build a society to me, so I don't necessarily see the problem of evil as a massive barrier.
Okay.
I think it's solvable because even from an evolutionary standpoint, you could make the argument that taking the Nietzschean view to its fullest extent destroys culture, doesn't allow culture to continue to exist. But I don't know, that's just first reaction.
If it destroys culture, then, you know, why does it exist? Why does the creator allow it to exist? That's really what the problem of evil is getting at.
It's a tough problem from that perspective.
I believe you started to articulate one of the classic approaches to this.
Yeah.
Ultimately, it's not philosophically sound when we say that evil exists for the fitness of the world or the goodness of the world. Evil must exist, you know, as a contrast to beauty, to good things, so it's more beautiful.
So you're against the dichotomy.
It's not a good argument. Well, when it comes down to it, we could imagine beauty being perfectly good. We could imagine that evil just doesn't exist. And it's better that way. We can imagine people growing, personally, we'll say, or, you know, in attributes, without evil existing.
Sure.
Just purely from good things, you can grow. And so you don't need evil for those reasons, is what I'm getting at.
And why does that get rid of the problem, essentially?
No, what I'm saying is, that argument doesn't get rid of the problem.
That's what I was. That's what I was feeling. Is
we're on
the problem
route.
Doesn't necessarily disappear.
The reason I bring the problem of evil up, and I want to kind of
it's very interesting.
Harp on it a bit more,
please,
is because it's pretty much the main argument that skeptics, that atheists, etc., of there being an eternal personable being, bring to the table. And so when we go down this road and we consider the arguments, you know, within ourselves, of, and we're like, okay, you know, we can see these attributes that we're going towards on a metaphysical level, therefore the ultimate metaphysical reality must embody these attributes. When we go down that road of reasoning, which we've gone down, to people who are skeptical of God, they'll say, then why does evil exist? Like, that's the response, the first response, the big response.
If there is this higher form of love, euphoria,
then why
peace? Okay,
yeah.
Interesting. Okay, all right.
See, so I wanted to come here because it's probably what our listeners were thinking about too when we're going down these roads. It's like, you just pulled out metaphysical realities. Okay, yeah. Why does evil exist then? You know, it's the gotcha question.
Absolutely.
And historically, it has been pretty difficult. Of course, from the early church on, there have been pretty good arguments about it. They have to do with free will when it comes down to it. More recently, there's been much better arguments for it. So, Alvin Plantinga, maybe? Anyways, he wrote a book called God, Freedom, and Evil. And in this book is a libertarian free will approach to the problem of evil that defeats the problem of evil, I'll say, philosophically speaking, and I can explain that momentarily. The problem I have with him and his work is it's kind of based on Molinism, which is a view that God has a middle knowledge of reality. He only knows of the possibilities in the future, the options in the future, and not the reality of the future, which I'm not a big fan of. It denigrates his eternalness.
Is there a philosophical answer to the problem of evil? Because I'm hearing some very strong theological arguments.
I haven't really given any so far.
Sure.
His is philosophical. He's a dean at a philosophy school. Yeah. Or at a college of philosophy.
That's cool.
Big school, yeah. I probably should have more notes on him. I wasn't really planning on talking about him today. But anyways, effectively, his argument says that the evil it can exist because there is an option for why it can exist. Okay, so when we get down to it, I should just read my notes, but it'll be better doing freehand.
Go, please.
So when it comes down to it, what we're saying, what the argument of the problem of evil says is that necessarily evil shouldn't exist.
And so it's this implied mm-hmm. thing. There's this bridge between the two statements. And it's an implication. And so we're saying that it's impossible for evil to exist in light of an almighty, all-knowing good God.
Hmm.
So this good God would necessarily remove the evil because he's good. That's what the argument's really saying. And so what this God, freedom, and evil argument brings out is that he's saying, no, it's not actually necessary that God removes evil. And here's why. In creation, God had the options of making people one way or another. He could have made us with personhood or without personhood.
Hmm.
This is this kind of spirit soul thing I was getting
at. I see what you're saying. Okay.
He could have made us with free will or determined. You know, this is going again towards the spirit soul thing, using different words this time that highlights the biological machine aspect versus autonomous being aspect. And so if we just consider those roughly four options there, if you draw a little matrix of the four.
Sure.
First of all, my response is, well, I'm really glad that we have a free will. I'm really glad that we're not deterministic beings. I'm really glad that we have personhood.
Yeah. You know? So the argument there is that personhood is defined as not the, you know, the toy of a creator, but personhood, for it to be full personhood, must be...
an aspect of autonomy.
There must be an aspect of autonomy
free
to
will.
It. Okay, all right.
And so, this isn't quite the argument he goes down. This is more of Augustine, still, although he uses a lot of Augustine's in his work. But anyways, when we first, right off the bat, we're saying, okay, great. We'd rather have free will than not. I think that's good. However, that doesn't quite defeat the problem of evil yet, because we could still say, well, couldn't God just make us with a free will and make sure evil doesn't exist? We could go on with our free will, never sinning.
Because the question I could lob in your direction is, okay, if the creation seemingly instantly vaulted off into wickedness, does that not mean that the creation was flawed and therefore that the creator was flawed in creating that? What if evil is an essential part of this, and this is not necessarily a world we want to live in?
Yeah. And that's exactly it. And so that's pretty much where it's called a theodicy when you try to answer the problem of evil. There's literally a term for attempted attempts. It's called theodicies. So that's pretty much where Augustine's theodicy is defeated, what you just pointed out. And so while it sufficed for the church throughout centuries and centuries as the premier theodicy, it ultimately fails philosophically because of what you just pointed out. And so this is where this new approach with our modern philosophical tools comes in. This is why we have specific definitions for what it means to be free will, the libertarian, I think it's just called the libertarian free will, where I can briefly define that, where you actually have two options and you actually aren't pushed towards one or the other arbitrarily.
See, that's what's interesting, because, you know, what does the Sam Harris type person say to this, who believes that the nature of all of this is deterministic? And
yes.
I'm not going to say what I believe, but I will say that the deterministic view of this has some weight.
Yeah.
Going all the way back to the beginning of the episode, the farmer looks out into his field and sees a field of locust coming from the east and devours his field. He sees all of these cataclysms that he cannot control, even though he's taken every step of his free will to deal with it. And the image used in the book is that free will is like a man paddling in a little ship on a vast ocean.
Yeah.
And he can paddle any direction he wants.
But he doesn't really have...
But the ocean will do with him as it will.
And that's good. I think that you pointed out a key differentiation here for the libertarian view of free will versus the non-libertarian or whichever other view you take. The libertarian one says, no, the man really can have different outcomes from his actions.
Yeah.
And so you're making a pretty strong statement about the free willness here.
How much of an optimist are you is basically what it determines.
Right, right. And so again, I'm not all that keen on this argument. I think it's an option. And I think that if you are to engage in the philosophical world, enough people will respect your premise of, well, given libertarian free will, therefore, it works really well as a theodicy with that premise. And so it's almost like we were talking about with the ontological, almost you have to get on the same basis, really, before you go down the road.
That's interesting. So there's really, is there any way to deal with the problem of evil in a non...
In a deterministic sense?
Yeah.
There kind of is, but not really. So when it comes down to it, if God predetermines everything, including doesn't get... If he doesn't give humans moral agency, in the libertarian free will sense, then God is making evil. And this is where you get into kind of the Calvinist issues with the double predestination and stuff like that. It's like, well, if man doesn't really have a choice,
oh man,
then
yeah. We're...
So it's hard because as someone coming from that background who really respects determinism because it seems to give the most power to God, I have a hard time with it because the more Molinist approach, this free will approach, it's like, it's a little bit more philosophically sound when it comes down to it.
So, I can make a natural, it might be very theologically sound, but I can make a natural man's argument here for the deterministic.
Yeah. Because I think you're right. There are philosophers, Sam Harris is a good example, who determinism is it.
And that's really the way I see it, is that ultimately, think about it, what forms the morals in a child?
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, if a child is raised in a culture that gives it certain values, those values, it 9 times out of 10 will be the values that child values. There seems to be a deterministic course to all of this. That's just one example of how things seem to be set in stone. There's really no way of getting out of it. So because of that, I tend to take the logical leap and say determinism is not something that is an opinion to be held. It is a fact of existence.
Wow.
So then if things are determined, I'm bound. There's a boundness to my personhood. The problem of evil must be answered in the deterministic arena, which is tough for me.
Yeah. I don't really think you're going to find a suitable answer for it. And because of that, I think that determinism is weakened, in my view, because...
Must determinism not necessarily exist just because it makes things more difficult, though?
Yeah. No, I agree. It's hard. But, I would pose to a determinist, what does it mean for humans to have free will?
Hmm.
What does it actually mean? Are you outright rejecting it? Are you okay with outright rejecting it? Because when you outright reject it, you seem to lose moral culpability. You seem to lose moral... whatever the term is.
Responsibility.
Yeah, all of it. So...
This is good.
If that's the case, your whole system's screwed, you know?
That parable imagery is really the best thing I've come up with to describe the issue, is that it is determined that you are a little man marooned on a boat in a vast ocean.
And that might be the case.
It is determined that the ocean tends to have storms.
Yeah.
And it is also determined that you have the ability to paddle. So there is... something there, but what difference does it make? So then it's just an arbitrary thing about personality. Is he an optimist? Like, will they be pessimistic about what the man paddling can do?
Yeah.
But I'm also hoping that I've allowed you to formulate this as deeply as possible and
just
not interrupted.
No, I think your points are great for the sake of this conversation, but just to wrap up the planting the argument, you basically said that some worlds are possible to conceive of, but God can't actualize them. And those worlds, and you might balk at that if you're a Christian. These worlds specifically, as an example, are the ones where humans have moral free will, libertarian free will, and don't choose evil. God can't actualize that because he's giving over the power of morality to humans. And so they can choose evil. You know, God, and so this defeats the problem of evil intrinsically. So,
we're going to have to probably have a sidelights episode to convince me of that.
Yeah, I completely respect your view of determinism. I'm right there with you. I would rather
it.
Believe it.
I want to hear
when
it.
When you go down the libertarian free will route, I think this actually does defeat
so,
it. It's great.
It's not a puristic free will. It's almost like a, not necessarily a pure free will, but only a free will up to a point.
See, if God made... a world, and he said, you guys have moral free will. We'll just talk very simply.
Yeah.
If he made this world, how can he both make that world where they choose to do evil and that same world where they don't choose to do evil? Let's do a thought experiment here.
Hmm.
In both cases, let's say God makes the world that he makes in Genesis, okay?
Sure.
You know, Eve looks at this fruit, seems good to her. She eats it. Adam, who's with her, eats it too. Serpent deceives Eve, you know,
yeah,
et cetera.
Yeah, sure.
Let's say God made that world. Back up 10 minutes before they eat the fruit, okay? Hmm. At that point, the world is exactly the same, okay? Now, let's branch here. In one world, Eve decides, oh, no, I'm going to do the right thing. The serpent, obviously, is trying to, you know, take God's power, whatever. And so she doesn't eat the fruit. In this other world, she follows the path that's recorded in Genesis. She eats the fruit, bad things happen.
Sure.
Sin enters the world. God did nothing different. He made the same exact world in both cases. Do you see?
It's just
the
merely
human moral
choice.
Yes. And so the determinism view does remove that human moral choice. Whereas the biblical account seems to imply they're morally culpable. There's literal punishments, right?
All right, I'm going to fire back here. Must the nature of this metaphysical infinitude that we have found let go of any of this ability to forecast events? Can this metaphysical reality let go of any of its power? Would that empty it of a portion of its infinitude? Isn't it likely that because it is infinity, whatever that is, whatever it directs,
yeah,
is the directive, and because of that, that is good. And the problem of evil is a problem for the people who are positing it as a problem, because evil is not appropriately defined. The nature of whatever this is good no matter what, even though you don't want to admit that the potter can do what he wants with the clay.
That is another classical argument.
I don't know, and I'm a lot of people
that the determinists approach for. Yeah, I don't know that I'll counter it, because I think it's just different bases. I don't know. Basically, what I'm advocating for here is that we hold in very careful tension the power of God with moral responsibility.
For sure.
If we give away either, I think we're living in clown world. I think we're wrong.
Clown world, that's good. Okay, well, this goes back to the natural philosophy thing, which is just ultimately, how do you define the nature of your eternal variable? Is it just a essence, a stone?
Yeah, we've gone way behind that.
Let's just maybe just say for a second.
Let's take a step back.
Whatever this essence is doesn't really care how humans feel about the problems they see in the world.
Well, then why would he have made anything?
That's going to get us, you know, to the next philosophical thing. And I think that this goes back to your anthropological argument, and this is going to be something we discuss, folks, in the next book club.
Yeah.
Because if you take the anthropological argument far enough in terms of human action, there's something even beyond the eternal variable of love or euphoria or peace. And religious people might call that something to the effect of glory or worship or praise.
Yeah. Well,
I don't know. There's a lot of
if you want to get towards glory, we can pretty much say if there is an eternal good being, as the ontological argument conceives of, it is, if we're speaking strictly ontologically and not religiously, worthy, weighty, sufficiently incredible for us to try and come into alignment with, i.e. obey absolutely and never do anything against
Even if it's, you know, the energy ball at the center of the universe that propagated the Big Bang. Whatever this thing is.
Yes.
If it is infinite, it is worthy of some sort of
awe.
Weightiness.
Yes.
And what I think we've discussed throughout this conversation, folks, I hope brings us to the precipice of saying, you know, something's out there. There is something
We've gone a bit beyond that, yeah. And yes, that's really where we were trying to get to this conversation. I know the problem of evil
is
a sidelight.
Here's why I think it's important. It's not a sidelight.
Yeah.
It's not a sidelight at all. That's actually my answer
Okay.
to the fact that people even feel they have the ability to posit the problem of evil.
Yeah.
People feel they have the ability to posit the problem of evil, but don't realize that the weight of their essence is infinitely less weighty than whatever this infinite weightiness is. Therefore, whatever the infinite weightiness directs as being,
yeah,
gets to be being.
See, you're doing this from a determinist standpoint. I think you overstated just a bit.
Okay, all right. Tell me,
but
this is good. This is very good.
You used the word infinite like 6 times. I think I've only used it maybe twice.
Okay.
Effectively, I would not diminish the human sense of morality as far as you did. Now, yes, eternity and eternal metaphysical realities must infinitely outweigh whatever realities we have.
Hmm.
But we do exist.
We do.
We do seem to exist.
We do seem.
That's not to say infinite other universes don't exist, but we seem to exist, so that's nice. Anyways, just a slight critique on that statement.
All right, that's good. Well, I think we're definitely going to have ongoing discussions on this in the book club as well as in this podcast, folks. And, you know, that's really probably an unopened page for us. And, you know, I hope that you will follow us in that journey as we continue to discuss it, because it's very new to me. And I look forward to discussing it. And I hope that you will ask these great questions with us. I hope you will consider your being, the infinitude or lack thereof of your being.
Look into thyself. Use reason as your guide.
Know thyself.
See what you find.
Know thyself.
Absolutely.
All right. This has been the Narratives in Philosophy Podcasts with your hosts, Jacob and Brandon Moore.